This is KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. Streaming at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of June 10, 2024. On Tuesday, June 11th at 3 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board, CAB, No Food Wasted Work Group, will be meeting virtually. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. Also on Tuesday, June 11th, but at 5 p.m., Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be meeting virtually at 5 p.m. For details on how to join, see CorvallisOregon.gov. Also on Tuesday, June 11th, but at 6:30 p.m., the Historic Resources Commission meeting will be held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. For details on how to attend the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, June 12th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Operational Advisory Committee meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. For details on how to attend the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, June 13th at 9 a.m., the Civic Beautification and Urban Forestry Department Advisory Committee meeting will be held at the Corvallis Parks and Recreation Administration Building, 1310 Southwest Avery Park Drive. On Saturday, June 15th, 10 a.m. to noon, Corvallis City Councilor for Ward 2, Bria Lewis, will be holding Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis Benton County Public Library. Feel free to stop by to say hello and ask questions about your local government. 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. This is Dan Krall. I am joined by Michelle, who is a parent of two children in the Corvallis School District. And from what I understand, there's an important meeting coming up this week.
Yes, so there's a school board meeting on Thursday, the last one of the school year. And
this coming Thursday.
At 6 p.m., Lincoln Elementary Gym. Some concerned parents and I have gotten together a petition, so we plan to present that at the Thursday school board meeting. We just want to, we've been working with a school board member who feels that there is hope that we can tweak slightly the reserves that the district has so we can continue to fund our skills trainers, librarian, and art and music teachers that have been defunded like within the last month and are not coming back next year. Once those positions go away, it's very hard to bring them back. So we're hoping that we can keep them and come up with other ways to fund them into the future. The budget shortfall of $8.2 million is because of the lack of affordable housing in Corvallis. And so less families are moving here. So less enrollment in the district means less funding from the state for education. But it's not acceptable to us to have staff that meet with extremely high needs kids and also the library and art. We need those teachers, so we need to find other ways to fund these positions and not have them be lost forever.
Well, for those who may not be following the story, what cuts have been made recently?
Recent cuts include inclusion assistance, which are assistance that are extremely useful in ensuring that all students have access to all the classes and specials. Libraries have been reduced to quarter time and sharing schools, and art teachers have been laid off in elementary and middle schools across the district.
Do you know why this shortfall has happened?
It's the lack of affordable housing in Corvallis, meaning less families are moving here and the enrollments are down in all of the schools. And so that means because of state law, which was enacted, I believe, in the 90s, the funding from the state is based on enrollment numbers. So when those go down, so does our funding.
And there's just been lower numbers in the district.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean we can cut out library and other essential skills that engage students. I feel that library, art, and music are what brings joy to students and what makes them want to learn to read and do math. Those things are the most engaging parts of our kids' days, so we can't lose them.
I feel like I'm paraphrasing, but I once heard it said that, yes, we need doctors and people to provide essential services for our lives so that we can live our lives and enjoy things like art, music, good books, quality of life things.
Exactly. And we've been in budget downturns before, so it's nothing new, but we do not want to lose these positions. They're extremely hard to claw back once lost. So I just want the school board and the superintendent to prioritize them and find other ways to ride out the budget shortfall. Yes, we need more affordable housing in Corvallis, but until that's solved, we can't let reading scores go even further down. They're the lowest they've been in 30 years in Oregon. And just for myself, this is unacceptable to cut these positions, and I don't want to tell my daughters that I'm not doing anything. So we formed this petition and are going to the school board Thursday night wearing red and presenting it to the district and the board.
Okay, so that's this coming Thursday for those of you listening out there, and that's going to be at Lincoln Elementary, which is here along Southwest 3rd Street in South Corvallis, across from the Les Schwab, if you're not familiar with where Lincoln is. And how many petition signatures do you have so far on this petition?
Well, it's increasing all the time, hopefully around 200 right now.
And what is specified in the petition? What is it you're asking of the superintendent on the petition and this coming Thursday?
We worked with a school board member to let us know that there is a way that we can tweak the reserves, the emergency funding that the district does, and make available $954,000, which can be used to maintain these positions into next year. These staffs that work directly with students every day.
All right. Well, this is Michelle. She is a parent of two kids in the Corvallis School District. And this coming Thursday, 6 p.m. at Lincoln Elementary, you will have your chance alongside parents like Michelle to hopefully retain these crucial positions. And I'd like to thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Hope everyone can come out that feels strongly we need library programs and music and art and skills trainers.
You may have noticed a new housing complex under construction in South Corvallis on the corner of Highway 99 and Wake Robin Avenue. Here's a little info on the new development. The Union at Pacific Highway is being developed by the Annex Group. It's on 7 acres and will offer 174 apartments to those earning less than 60% of our area's median income. It will include 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments, a community center, a fitness center, playground, gardens, a dog park, activity rooms, a picnic area, and other amenities. Major demand is expected from OSU students, and the complex will be operated under the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program, created in 1986 as part of the Tax Reform Act. According to the Annex Group, the project budget is $56 million, and according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, a single Corvallis resident must earn less than $45,360 annually to qualify for affordable rental housing. For some context on the housing crisis in Oregon, in 2023, Governor Tina Kotek tried unsuccessfully to pass a Senate bill aiming to expand zoning for housing in Oregon cities by easing restrictions on such development. Numerous bills have faced opposition from environmental advocates in recent years, who note that new laws would allow urban sprawl to replace natural areas and farmland, including crucial habitats like wetlands. In the past half century, Oregon state laws have somewhat restricted urban sprawl relative to other states, something residents and lawmakers appear to value. Now in 2024, Governor Kotek has negotiated with lawmakers to address city infrastructure and add qualifications for rezoning and expansion. Senate Bills 1530 and 1537, along with House Bill 4134, together would make for a $376 million investment in infrastructure funding, home building, homeless shelters, and rental assistance. Governor Kotek's new proposal would allow cities outside the Portland metro area with populations above 25,000 to expand by 100 acres, down from 150 in her initial efforts. But not before proving that they need more land and ensuring that at least 30% of new housing would be defined as affordable. $75 million of the new proposal would be used for a revolving loan fund that cities could allocate to low and moderate income housing targeted at people who don't qualify for affordable housing but still earn too little to afford buying a home at current prices. Another $65 million would keep homeless shelters operating, and $34 million would aim to provide rent assistance to struggling Oregonians. Last March, Governor Kotek stated that she may seek to loosen restrictions on city expansion set forth in the new laws, depending on whether the bills succeed in their goals.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2 and repeated 5 to 6 p.m. on Mondays. This is Dan Krall, and I am on location at the Lincoln Elementary Carnival. And where better to start the carnival than at the book fair? And I'm joined by a volunteer, Alice Hazelgrove, who is the grandmother of a third grader at Lincoln Elementary and also a volunteer with the book fair. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
Tell us about some of the highlights in this book fair. What seems to be popular with the kids this year?
Oh, definitely the graphic novels. They're loving it. The Dog Man, the Babysitter's Club, and anything that has an attachment, a pendant, a shark tooth that comes with it that kind of gives life to the book. There's a lot of really cool stuff like glow-in-the-dark, sea monsters. And because Lincoln is a Spanish immersion school, lots and lots of books in Spanish, which is brilliant.
Yes, I did notice a Spanish selection. And, of course, there's books on facts and statistics. Lots. There's teen reads, graphic novels, as you mentioned. It looks like a pretty healthy science section also.
Very much so. And I think that's one of the things that is really, for an older person like me, is encouraging, is seeing the kids. They still want to know facts, statistics, data. What's real? What is happening? What is history? What is science? And that, I'm a former children's librarian, and for me, that just raises my spirit. It's wonderful.
For sure. Where were you a librarian?
Well, originally in England, you may hear from the accent, in the city of London. But when I moved to America in 1981, I worked at my children's elementary school in Palo Alto, California, and I was the school librarian there.
Nice. And would you say that the kids and their interest levels these days is like when you were a librarian, or do you see a difference?
I don't. I think that curiosity is still there. The kids still want to hold a book, look at a book. I know they have access to all kinds of cool stuff in terms of websites and social media, but there's nothing like the joy of holding a real book and going, wait a minute, that was back here, flipping back a page or two to see what was there. And yes, the enthusiasm is immense. Yesterday, after school, we had a line that went all the way around the dining room, and every child was prepared to wait to buy their book, their bookmark, their fancy-schmancy pen. It's really encouraging for an old-timer librarian like myself.
And as we sit here, this is recorded on Saturday, by the way, Saturday the 6th of June. There are, well, at least several, about 24 kids that are in the book area right now, and this is near the entrance of the school. And beyond us, we have somebody giving out, it's not smoothies, it's a fruit concoction, though. It's dairy-free in these compostable cups, and then beyond that, they've got snacks and pizza and all that. And it's quite a, every year they do this Lincoln Carnival.
They do, and it's wonderful.
Have you been helping out at the Lincoln Carnival for several years?
No, I haven't. I started volunteering back last fall with the Oregon Battle of the Books, where the children read books and then they have competitions, trivia questions, questions about books, and they have elimination rounds. And I was a team coach for the OBOB team here. And that's how I got started volunteering.
Yeah. Do you find it fulfilling?
I find it incredibly fulfilling. When I retired, I wanted something that was giving forward to the next generation, and this absolutely does it. And this is definitely it's not my first Scholastic Fair. My first were back in the 80s and 90s when my kids were in elementary school. And here I am again, and it's as rewarding and as fun, and it's a great way of getting to meet the children and interact with the students and the teachers. And yeah, I'll be back. They can't get rid of me that easily.
And I would assume you probably are a reader yourself.
I'm a massive reader. People used to say to me, how do you read so many books? I go, well, when I'm cooking, I'm reading, and when I'm doing the laundry, I'm reading, and when I'm sitting at a traffic light, I'm reading. I was lucky enough to have parents who really encouraged reading and literacy, and you never lose that.
That's true. I think it's very important at a young age to get into the habit of reading. I can speak as a kid who grew up in the 80s during the advent of video games. I played more video games than I should have, and even to this day, I have shelves of books in my house. And I get to reading them, but not nearly as often as I should. And the absolute satisfaction that comes with reading a good book is one that is unmatched. It's one that a night of staring into the Reddit rabbit hole on your phone just can't provide. Or staring into the portal of Facebook, where you're just feeling like you're missing out on life and everyone's got it better than you. It does not compare to reading a good book.
I have a story, can I quickly tell you? When I was first a children's librarian in West London, very, very poor area, there was a little boy who used to come to my library. He was 5, and his mom worked, and she would drop him off, and he'd stay at the library until she finished work. And this child couldn't read, and we in the library taught him to read. He is now an author. 40-some years later, he's a published author because he came to the library, he read the books, he didn't have shoes that fit, but he had a love of reading, and that's the gift that's kept on giving.
Do you know this author's name?
Martin Crump.
What kind of author is he?
He writes science books, I think.
Yeah. Martin Crump. Yeah. Is that with a K or a C?
C, yeah.
I'll have to look him up. I was going to ask you, as a reader, what's the last really good book you read, or maybe a really great book that you're reading right now?
Well, right now I'm kind of buried in mysteries, and the mystery I'm reading is set in World War I in France, and there's been a crime committed on the battlefield, and one of the army nurses has to solve the crime. So you've got the story of what's going on in the trenches in northern France, but you've got this nurse who's solving a mystery. And I love the accuracy of the history that she uses. It's really wonderful. And we read, in my book group here in Corvallis, we read a lot of books about the importance of social change, the importance of social awareness. Because it's too easy to live in a bubble. Oh, I'm okay. I'm fine. No problems for me. But what's going on in the bigger world? What do we need to take care of? What do we need to be aware of? So we read a lot of books like that.
I think that's good, and that's a very good point. That's something I've actually been thinking about a lot, because we, in America, we're encouraged to live in our own bubbles. And it may just be a symptom of the modern world also. But we do realize that society's problems become our problems eventually. I mean, just locally here, you see the problems with the unhoused community. I mean, that very much is a wake-up call that you can't just ignore problems. They become all of our problems eventually.
Well, exactly. And I've been aware of that. I'm 68, and I've been aware of that my whole life. My parents were very socially aware. I raised my children to be socially aware. And now I've got a granddaughter who's socially aware. And hopefully she's the generation that will continue to make things happen.
That's really our only hope.
Absolutely. Can't change that. Yes, it's great.
Alice Hazelwood, thank you so much for your time. Alice is a volunteer with the book fair here at the Lincoln Elementary Carnival. This recording this recording was made Saturday, June 6th, and you are listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, which you can hear Sundays from 1 to 2. We'll come back to the Lincoln Carnival a little bit later this hour. I'd like to thank you again, Alice, for your time.
You're welcome. Come on down to the carnival. They'll have to make it next year, but we're going to be here.
They will. They are here every year at the Lincoln Elementary property here in South Corvallis, just off of 3rd Street. Thanks for joining us today for KORC News, Music, and Civics. We'll visit with some other amenities of the carnival a little bit later this hour.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The following is an article in the Associated Press written by Mae Anderson, Paul Harloff, and Barbara Ortute, entitled CEOs Got Big Salary Increases Last Year. Survey Shows Widening Pay Gap with Workers. New York. The typical compensation package for chief executives who run companies in the S&P 500 jumped nearly 13% last year, easily surpassing the gains for workers at a time when inflation was putting considerable pressure on Americans' budgets. The median pay package for CEOs rose to $16.3 million, up 12.6%, according to data analyzed for the Associated Press by Equilar. Meanwhile, wages and benefits netted by private sector workers rose 4.1% through 2023. At half the companies in AP's annual pay survey, it would take the worker at the middle of the company's pay scale almost 200 years to make what their CEO did. Quote, "In this post-pandemic market, the desire is for boards to reward and retain CEOs when they feel like they have a good leader in place," unquote, said Kelly Malafis, founding partner of Compensation Advisory Partners in New York. The AP's CEO compensation survey included pay data for 341 executives at S&P 500 companies who have served at least two full consecutive fiscal years at their companies, which filed proxy statements between January 1st and April 30th. Hawk Tan, the CEO of Broadcom, topped the survey with a pay package valued at about $162 million. Broadcom granted Tan stock awards valued at $160.5 million on October 31st, 2022, for the company's 2023 fiscal year. Tan was given the opportunity to earn up to 1 million shares starting in fiscal 2025, according to a securities filing, provided that Broadcom stock meets certain targets, and he remains CEO for 5 years. At the time of the award, Broadcom stock was trading at $470. The stock has skyrocketed since and reached an all-time high of $1,436.17. on May 15th. Tan will receive the full award if the average closing price is at or above $1,125 for 20 consecutive days between October 2025 and October 2027. Broadcom noted that under Tan, its market value has increased from $3.8 billion in 2009 to $645 billion as of May 23rd. And that its total shareholder return during that time easily surpassed that of the S&P 500. Other CEOs at the top of AP's survey are William Lansing of Fair Isaac Corp. at $66.3 million, Tim Cook of Apple Incorporated, $63.2 million, Hamid Magadam of Prologis Incorporated, $50.9 million, and Ted Sarandos, co-CEO of Netflix, $49.8 million. More women made the AP survey than in previous years, but their numbers in the corner office are still minuscule compared to their male counterparts. Of the 341 CEOs included in Equilar's data, 25 were women. Lisa Su, CEO and chair of the board of chipmaker Advanced Micro Devices, was the highest paid female CEO in the AP survey for the fifth year in a row in fiscal 2023, bringing the compensation valued at $30.3 million, flat with her compensation package in 2022. Her overall rank rose to 21 from 25. The other top-paid female CEOs include Mary Barra of automaker General Motors, $27.8 million, Jan Fraser of banking giant Citigroup, $25.5 million, Kathy Warden of aerospace and defense company Northrop Grumman Corp., $23.5 million, and Carol Tome of package deliverer UPS Incorporated at $23.4 million. The median pay package for female CEOs rose 21% to $17.6 million. That's better than their male counterparts fared. Their median pay package rose 12.2% to $16.3 million. Workers across the country have been winning higher pay since the pandemic, with wages and benefits for private sector employees rising 4.1% in 2023 after a 5.1% increase in 2022, according to the Labor Department. Even with those gains, the gap between the person in the corner office and everyone else keeps getting wider. Half the CEOs in this year's pay survey made at least 196 times what their median employee earned. That's up from 185 times in last year's survey. The disparity between what the chief executives make and the workers wasn't always so wide. After World War II and up until the 1980s, CEOs of large publicly traded companies made about 40 to 50 times the average worker's pay, said Brandon Rees, Deputy Director of Corporations and Capital Markets for the AFL-CIO, which runs an executive pay watch website that tracks CEO pay. Quote, "The current pay ratio signals a sort of winner-takes-all culture, that companies are treating their CEOs as, you know, as superstars as opposed to team players," Rees said. Despite the criticism, shareholders tend to give overwhelming support to pay packages for company leaders. From 2019 to 2023, companies typically received just under 90% of the vote for their executive compensation plans, according to data from Ecular. Shareholders do, however, occasionally reject a compensation plan, although the votes are non-binding. In 2023, shareholders at 13 companies in the S&P 500 gave the pay package less than 50% support. Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Progressive Institute for Policy Studies, said say-on-pay votes are important because they, quote, "shine a spotlight on some of the most egregious cases of executive access, and it can lead to negotiations over pay and other issues that shareholders might want to raise with corporate leadership," unquote. After its investors gave another resounding thumbs down to the pay packages for its top executives, Netflix met with many of its biggest shareholders last year to discuss their concerns. Following the talks, Netflix announced several changes to redesign its pay policies. For one, it eliminated executives' choice to allocate their compensation between cash and options. It will no longer give out stock options, which can give executives a payday as long as the stock price stays above a certain level. Instead, the company will give restricted stock that executives can profit from only after a certain amount of time or after certain performance measures are met. The changes will take effect in 2024. More broadly, say-on-pay votes haven't made a big difference, Anderson says. Quote, "I think the impact, certainly on the overall size of CEO packages, has not had much effect in some cases," unquote. That was the Associated Press article titled, "CEOs Got Big Salary Increases Last Year," written by Mae Anderson, Paul Harloff, and Barbara Ortute. You're listening to KORC.
Helly strip mall in Virginia, fast food in Walmart, endless subdivisions. Life is drab here.
paved over the trees, roadkill and garbage blowing in the breeze. Country roads take me home, pass a blind near my job, endless red lights, no enjoyment. Take me home, country roads. Gas now, but the potholes keep getting bigger. I feel bad for all those walking by. It's really scary, seems like they might die. Country roads take me home, pass the blind near my job.
That was a parody of the famous John Denver song, Take Me Home Country Roads. Instead, Take Me Home Country Strodes. Now you may say, what is a strode? It is a street-road hybrid. They are very dangerous overall, enormously expensive to build, and ultimately financially unproductive. While Corvallis isn't necessarily strode town, if you've been to places like Albany, Bend, Salem, Portland, strodes are common in most cities across the U.S. and Canada. And it never really hurts to have a vocabulary to realize why certain places are more dangerous or just more miserable. And it never hurts to rethink how we approach these types of things in the future. Here's the voice of Charles L. Marone. He is the president of a group called Strong Towns. They had a part in creating that parody song we just heard.
In this country, we're having a huge debate over transportation spending. How do we find more money to continue to do the things that we currently do? We actually need to be having a conversation about how to do things differently, how to take the money we have already invested and get better use out of it. If you're traveling more than 20 miles an hour and less than 50 miles an hour, you are on a strode. A strode tries to do two things at once and does neither of them well. It tries to be both street and road. What's the difference? A road we can think of as a replacement of the railroad, which of course is a road on rails. And in a railroad, you would get on at one spot and you would get off at another. And there's a high speed connection between the two. We want people to get from one place to another as quickly as possible. We widen out the lanes, we put in sweeping, forgiving geometries. We're trying to move people from one productive place to another productive place. When we build roadways to serve as high-speed connections, when we don't encumber them with accesses and turnoffs and interchanges, what we see is that we can make very cost-effective investments and move a lot of people very, very quickly. What is a street then? A street is, and always has been, a platform for building wealth. It's a platform for creating value within a place. As an engineer, we design streets by the foot. And what we're looking for from a financial standpoint is how much return do we get per foot that we put in. In a really good street environment, what we see is that the design is actually narrower streets, wider sidewalks. It's designed for people. It's designed for people to freely flow back and forth. You're gonna have sidewalks, you're gonna have good spacing, you're gonna have slow traffic, you're gonna have on-street parking, you're gonna have the ability of people to safely move from place to place in that environment. We can effectively build wealth-creating streets where we embrace the complexity and we work with it to incrementally improve the place over time with the budgets that our cities have. The problem comes when we try to do both, when we try to both move traffic quickly and create wealth. In those environments, we wind up with a strode. When you get into a strode environment, you get these signs that are out of scale. When you're driving along, they're actually not big enough to work for you, but when you're walking along, they're way too big, they're way out of scale. Strodes are incredibly expensive to build. Extra lanes, extra wide lanes, an attempt to essentially build highway-style roadways in places where we don't expect highway-style speeds. We put in traffic signals, we put in stop signs, we put in things that slow you down. Beyond that, they're not safe. So even though we've invested a lot of money to move cars quickly, nobody moves very quickly. These are incredibly expensive places to build, and the return we get for that investment is very low. As a nation, what we need to do is forget about trying to create a whole bunch more money to continue building what we've already shown doesn't work. We have to actually have a dialogue about how we take our existing strodes and convert them to either wealth-creating streets or high-performance roadways. Roadways that connect our places, places that build wealth and value. If we can do that, we can spend less, we can get more.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. Thanks for joining us today. I am at the Lincoln Carnival, which is a yearly event put on at the end of the school year. There are students, parents. Earlier this hour, if you've been tuned in, I was at the book fair to get started on this roving tour of the good times being had. And right now, I am joined by Michelle of the Corvallis Environmental Center, who is setting out compostable cups to make what is called, will you tell us the name of this drink?
Hey, it's the strawberry granita. It's a really simple recipe using fresh local strawberries, a little lime, a little agave syrup, and a titch of mint.
I thought these were smoothies at first, but nope, they are dairy-free. It's not exactly a smoothie.
That's right, yeah, and I don't miss the dairy, do you?
No. I'm actually looking at the recipe. Why don't you tell us again, give us an idea, those listening on the air, how they might make one of these at home.
Oh, it's super easy. I froze strawberries from Oso Farm, which is in South Corvallis. Great local farm. They have a farm stand over by the airport. So we froze them to preserve the freshness, and then you just do 2 cups of them, 2 cups of water, half a cup of agave syrup, if desired, half a cup of lime juice. I just use bottled lime juice, and then just some mint leaves to taste, and just blend it up, and it's amazing. Very, very good for you.
They are giving out samples. Would you, young man, like to try one of these?
I already did, right?
Solomon, the KORC kid.
Would you put anything different in them if you were making them?
I don't know. No. Okay.
Maybe add banana?
Sure, that would make it sweeter instead of the agave if you don't have that lying around. Banana is a great option, and that kind of makes it seem like there's dairy in it too.
Can I have an extra one?
Yeah,
yes.
Go for it. At Corvallis Environmental Center, we go into schools. We were in 50 schools last month making a fresh, healthy recipe and just getting kids to try something new in a peer setting. And having them help make it is really great to encourage them trying new foods and always local, fresh, and healthy. So a few of our recipes this year were spinach salad with balsamic vinaigrette, which was actually a favorite. So was green beans haricot vert with a orange juice glaze. What else? Barley bowls. Those are pretty popular. And always with something local and seasonal for the harvest of the month.
One of the most easily looked over building blocks is just being properly nourished. Sometimes just proper nourishment and with local fresh food, it can make all the difference in the world.
We at the Corvallis Environmental Center are empowering kids to make their own food choices, and just introducing fresh, healthy vegetables and fruits is why we do what we do.
I have found myself in a really bad pattern lately of eating lots of chicken from the store that's hot and ready to go, fried often, fast food, and I need to get out of this cycle.
Yeah, when we get busy, it's really easy to fall into that habit, but once you make a few recipes yourself, you realize how easy it is to eat healthy.
We live in a very special part of the world with food security and good drinking water. We really should not take that for granted. When you go somewhere like Southern California and taste the water, you realize one of the greatest amenities is what we have up here, good drinking water.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can grow things year-round. You can get kale out of your pots or out of your garden year-round. It's amazing. So,
and we've got a good knowledge base of local folks that are very good with growing, and you just got to tap into those local resources. Sometimes go out these events, meet people. Don't be shy. Just go up and talk to some of these folks at the tables. They've got some good ideas. I've learned a lot over the years just with the curiosity.
This isn't your 70s home ec class, right? Or 80s. We're stepping in to, you know, there is a missed opportunity of feeding kids at school in a peer setting. And just something as simple as a balsamic vinaigrette on spinach and kale is just revolutionary.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for your time. And thanks for being here, providing good, healthy food for everyone.
Thank you. It's great talking with you. Thanks for stopping by.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm going to read an article from the Oregon Capital Chronicle from this week. And the headline reads, Oregon lags most states in public higher education funding, a report finds. And the author is Alex Baumhard. Oregon State University in Corvallis is one of the most expensive public 4 years in the state to attend. The university, along with the 6 other public universities in Oregon, is raising tuition for students next year. The Oregon legislature continues to spend far less on higher education than other states, according to a new report, leading to some of the highest costs of attendance among universities in the West. Oregon is ranked 44th in the nation for public funding of higher education and 37th in the nation for per pupil funding, according to the latest annual State Higher Education Finance Report from the Colorado-based State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, HECC, is also a member of that association. The report compared state-by-state funding data from the 2022-23 fiscal year. While higher education investment in Oregon has increased in recent years, it has not been enough to make up for more than a decade of underfunding and of relying heavily on student tuition to cover rising costs, according to Ben Hannon, the executive director of that commission. Cannon and university presidents have repeatedly asked the legislature for more higher education dollars and a model of funding that balances state investment with tuition revenue. Cannon said, "We are continuing to rely on students to balance our budgets." Enrollment declines across Oregon's 7 public universities and 17 community colleges over the last 5 to 10 years have been more than twice the national average, according to the report, making tuition an unreliable source of funding. Cannon said, "Over the next 10 years, or whatever portion of that 10 years I'm around for, I will hope to partner with the legislature to restore the public in our public system of higher education. Per pupil investment in Oregon's public higher education system was more than $2,500 less than the national average last year, according to the Higher Education Finance Report. In Oregon, during the 2022-23 school year, the state invested about $8,400 per full-time enrolled student each year. The national average that year was more than $11,000 per student. State investments in financial aid for middle and low-income students have increased in the last decade, but still fall behind national averages. Washington invests twice as much funding in scholarships for such students compared to Oregon. Quote, "You have a situation in Oregon right now where the vast majority of Oregon's public university presidents are from outside of the state, and we're shocked," said Eastern Oregon University President Kelly Ryan, who took over in 2023. Quote, "We are shocked at what we found. And we're also in wonderment about how we're supposed to get our work done in such a drastically underfunded environment," unquote. Ryan had to cut 8.4% of the university's budget for the 2023-24 school year, which was about $5 million. She said they, meaning the legislature, acknowledge we're really important to building a tax base, building a workforce, but it's hard for us to stay front and center, unquote. Oregon's higher education funding model has relied since the 2008 recession more heavily than many other states on raising tuition to cover rising operational costs, with funding since then cut in half. Quote, "A whole lot of students took on a whole lot of debt in order to help the state keep its corrections department, human services department, and K-12 systems afloat during the worst recession anyone had seen in their living memories," unquote, said Ben Cannon. Oregon's public universities and colleges now derive 32% more of their revenue from tuition than most public higher education institutions in the country. Between 2013 and 2023, revenue growth from student tuition in Oregon increased by 23%. The national average for tuition revenue growth was 1.5% during that same period. Every one of Oregon's seven public universities is increasing tuition in the upcoming school year and has done so just about every year for the past 10 years. Average tuition at those schools today is about 26% higher than it was a decade ago. The rising costs of housing around Oregon's universities have also driven up costs and affordability concerns, according to Cannon. He said, "A state that invests relatively little is going to have institutions that are likely going to have relatively high tuition." And that's absolutely what this report illustrates, he told the Capital Chronicle. This story, again, was from the Oregon Capital Chronicle and was written by Alex Baumhard. You're listening to KORC.
The following is a report from our own Lava Lamp Larry. In the report, you hear him reference last week's Supreme Court decision. This aired 2 weeks ago on KORC News Music and Civics, and the reference is regarding a decision made on May 20th by the Supreme Court. This is KORC.
Oregon established vote by mail as the standard mechanism for voting with Ballot Measure 60, a citizens' initiative, in 1998. The measure made Oregon the first state in the United States to conduct its elections exclusively by mail. However, Oregon Republicans, perhaps tiring of almost never winning statewide offices in our blue state, filed a lawsuit arguing that Oregonians suffer from a crisis of confidence in their election system and that election officials have violated the 14th Amendment by using electronic vote tabulation equipment. Last week, the United States Supreme Court, yes, that court, denied a request to hear a case seeking to overturn Oregon's mail-in voting system, officially putting an end to the lawsuit. Despite Oregon voters' reliance on mail-in voting, voters brought this lawsuit. Yes, we can safely say a few Republican voters, led by Republican Mark Thielman, who ran for election for governor of Oregon but lost in the Republican primary in May 2022. As evidence of the claims that Oregonians suffer from this crisis of confidence, the plaintiff cited the debunked right-wing propaganda movie 2000 Mules, which they claim shows for everyone to see illegal ballot trafficking during the 2020 election. Actually, Mr. Thielman, it does not show that. Plaintiffs also argued that every phantom vote cast disenfranchises a legitimate vote and requested that the court overturn the state's mail-in voting system. Last summer, the district court dismissed the lawsuit, but the plaintiffs appealed to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which subsequently dismissed the case in December. In their petition to the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs asked the court to address if they had the ability to bring the lawsuit as it was previously dismissed on standing grounds. The court declined to take up this request. In 2001, Oregon became the country's first universal mail-in voting state and has since been consistently high-ranked in terms of voter turnout. Mr. Thielman, the crisis is a crisis of ridiculous claims by failed Republican candidates. Overturning this system would be detrimental to Oregon voters who have voted by mail for decades. As former Governor Kate Brown wrote for Democracy Docket in 2020, when it comes to mail-in voting, Oregon is that friend who listened to music from bands before they were cool. We were the first state to conduct elections exclusively by mail. Since 2000, Oregon has mailed registered voters a ballot for every election. This policy change, made possible by a citizens' ballot initiative passed in 1998, has revolutionized democratic participation in our state and helped make elections more accessible. The Republican plaintiffs allege that the mantra of those who defend the current systems is that there's no evidence of fraud. But at the same time, they fail to show the public what is happening inside the black box machines that count the vote. Oregon is not the only state where mail-in voting and voting in many circumstances is under attack. Part of the right-wing crisis includes a suit filed on behalf of three voters with print disabilities and two blind advocacy groups against California Secretary of State Shirley Weber, a Democrat, challenging California's requirement to return mail-in ballots by paper-based methods. Print disabilities include blindness, visual impairment, intellectual disabilities, and other impairments that prevent a voter from reading, marking, or handling a paper ballot on their own, although voters with these disabilities can mark their ballots electronically. The, again, Republican plaintiffs allege this requirement is inaccessible to some blind voters who need accommodations to electronically submit their ballots. In Michigan, a lawsuit filed by the Republican National Committee, the Michigan Republican Party, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and others against Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, and Michigan Director of Elections Jonathan Brader, challenging the state's absentee ballot signature verification system. There's more. In Alabama, a lawsuit filed on behalf of five Alabama civil rights organizations against Republican Alabama Attorney General and the Republican District Attorneys for several counties challenging several provisions of Senate Bill 1, a new law that makes it illegal for individuals and organizations to assist voters in submitting their absentee ballots. Missouri, Texas, Arkansas, and Florida have all had similar voting challenges. Protect your right to vote by voting. Your next opportunity is in November. For KORC, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. This is Dan Krall on location, recorded Saturday at the Lincoln Carnival. Right now, there's a... What's the name of this dance? La Bamba?
Probably.
We are outside just enjoying the festivities. We're outside on the playground. They've got all kinds of kids' activities. There's a dunk tank, which I see someone sitting in the dunk tank. Every year they put on this carnival and fundraiser with activities for kids. It's free to attend. And this was recorded on Saturday. Yesterday, if you're listening on Sunday. This past Saturday, if you're catching the Monday rebroadcast. Make our way past the group dance. We see a dunk tank. A failed throw at the dunk tank. Kids line up, pay three tickets for a chance to dunk. Oh, anyone from a teacher? Whoa, that kid just threw the ball so off, almost hit someone in the head. Wow, there's another kid lined up.
Oh.
And he successfully dunked the teacher. Good job. He looks at me strangely, like, who's this guy with the microphone? Who is it that just got dunked?
I don't know.
Isn't that someone from your school?
No.
Solomon, the KORC kid. Little more somber than I was expecting, but... Oh, a close throw. Here at the dunk tank. Oh, within inches. Almost.
How many balls do I get?
He's giving it a third attempt. Vince Adams here at the dunk tank.
Oh, it's good to be here. Great day here in Lincoln.
Are you overseeing this?
Yeah, I do it every year. Have for since 2017.
Oh, wow. So you are the dunk tank master.
I'm the dunk tank guy.
Who are some of the people lined up to be dunked later today?
Well, I mean, we've got staff from here at the school, but we also have school board member Samuel Abdraba, and then we also have the mayor, Charles Mond, that's going to be in here at 2:15. You want to dunk him? Come on down.
Well, this is recorded on Saturday. Of course, you're hearing this on Sunday. I should ask, is there any open spots where, like, a random person could get up to be dunked?
No.
It's all
are
sanctioned.
Really enthusiastic to get in the tank to do this fundraising for Lincoln Elementary.
So the it's full.
You got to get in early.
Maybe I'd like to be dunked next year, although it looks like it's kind of cold.
It's lovely. It's a warm day here in Corvallis. Summer is hitting, and actually I think being in the dunk tank would be really nice.
Why don't you get up there on the dunk tank,
because
Vince Adams?
I'm always recruiting people to dunk teachers and public officials.
Have you ever been dunked here?
I've never been dunked here. Maybe it's my turn. I should be getting
in the dunk
tank. I think
so. I mean, so the kid just threw... It hit the lever, but it did not actually knock the person in. Who is that up there being dunked right now?
That is Amanda Poole. So, yeah, she's one of our teachers here at elementary, at Lincoln Elementary.
And she just went into the water.
Yeah, she just went in.
Well, tell us some of the other activities that are here within eyesight.
I mean, well, we have food. We have a family, the Lincoln family, that is cooking authentic Mexican food. We have Kona Ice, but we have a whole array of community partners here. I'm seeing Corvallis Public Schools Foundation. I'm seeing Benton County Public Health here helping support this event. And then we have a number of activities that are fun for kids. And, of course, we've got, you hear the music in the background. So we have student performances. We just had our student dancers here. They just performed. So there's a lot of stuff going on the whole time. So... Too bad you're seeing this on Sunday. Just mark this date next year.
Every year, Lincoln Carnival.
It's a great Southtown event.
It is. I've been to about three now. This is probably the third one I've been to. You've been to more than that, though, huh?
Well, my kids go here. I've got a fifth grader, but you know, there are people here that are Southtowners that had kids go through the school, but their kids have moved on, and they still come here and help put on this event. So it's not just about the school; it's a community event.
Definitely.
So I love it. I'll keep doing it as long as they keep inviting me back.
Vince Adams, overseeing the dunk tank activities here at the Lincoln Carnival. Thanks again for your time today.
Thanks very much. Take care.
All right, we're going to move on here a little. Get away from the muffled DJ in the background. I almost gave him a card to say, hey, tell everyone to listen to KORC tomorrow, but as you can hear, no one would understand that. So here's the tetherball courts. Got people playing tetherball. Would you guys like to play a game of tetherball?
I already did twice and I just beat Solomon.
It's been a while since I played tetherball. Competitive sport here. This is a recorded Saturday at the Lincoln Carnival. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. Before I end this recording, what fun festivities are we going to do before we go home?
Maybe have some food and walk around some more and see what other stuff there is to do.
Did you want a horchata?
No, not really.
All right. Well, they do have food for sale here. Mexican food looks pretty good. Well, we'll go ahead and stand in line for a snow cone and get on with this news hour. We do try to bring you community events as they happen, and we are looking for people to help tell these stories. We are looking for many voices to be on this program. Maybe that's you. Send us an email, info@korcfm.com. We will be in touch. Thanks for tuning in today.